All right. So I hope that all of you become as confused as Brock. Because Brock just found a serious bug using the best debugging tool that any of us have, namely his brain. And here's the bug. It's a subtle one, and it's not quite the one he thought initially, I don't think. Okay. So I claimed that we were never going to get stuck and we were going to resolve all this stuff in the right kind of a way. This turns out to be wrong. Let me give you the case. So, there's some process C, and it's proceeding through the kernel, and along the way it requires acquires a lock. So circles are locks, and I'm going to write the letter of the guy who holds them in them. The second process B, and B proceeds and it acquires one lock, and it attempts to acquire the lock held by C and can't because C holds it. Now let us further imagine that C is higher priority than B. So higher numbers are higher priority. C is 8, B is 7. Thus C is higher priority. B did not engage the finish or back off protocol. So B is going to sit there until C is done. Now the third process into the picture, which successfully acquires a lock, and then blocks attempting to acquire the lock held by B. I will give a $10,000 reward to anybody who can actually isolate this example in the wild. I want to talk to my partner before actually writing a check, but if I have to, I'll write it out of personal funds. Because if you can actually observe this in the wild, you're better than any other kernel designer I know anyway. These are not, these bugs by their nature are not very reproducible. So, suppose A is higher priority than B. Well, then A would say to B, get done or get out of the way. Yeah, B is already blocked. This is the case I think we have failed to check for. Now, why would this be bad? Well, already it's a problem if B can't get out of the way. But in fact, A could be higher priority than C. So this is a case where we actually need to forward propagate the dependency and tell C get done or get out of the way. Because ultimately, C is the source of the blockage here. And there are two arguments about this. One is, you don't fix this class of bug until you actually believe it's a problem. Because it doesn't happen. This will not satisfy the, over the break, Scott proposed the altitude metric of operating system reliability. This is how many thousand feet your plane loses before the OS recovers. This is, you know, ignoring the problem is not going to pass the altitude metric. The other possible solution is to say, if B is already blocked, tell him to get out of the way. And that's a check we can implement directly. That's probably what we ought to do in this case. So I have good news and bad news for Brock. The good news is that I'm going to put in place a policy that I should have put in place from the beginning, which is that if you spot an actual bug in the Eros code that's something we don't, excuse me, in the Kyoto's code that's something we don't already know about, it's good for a full letter grade raise. The bad news is that isn't going to help you because the registrar imposes a cap on the grades that I can give out, and so far nobody needs the help. But we'll keep it in mind. Sorry about that. Okay. So, and how many of you, okay, I said this in the mail list, but I do encourage you to at least get on the Kyoto's dev list. It's not a very high traffic list. Occasionally interesting anecdotes, both from us as we're building stuff and from other people who've built other systems. And also announcements about, you know, test images that you might actually want to look at, one of which went out last night or the night before. Somebody asked, where is Kyoto's running? The answer right now is nowhere. And I wouldn't encourage it anywhere, you know, outside of a development person's system. Its predecessors have run in banking, in transaction management, in network management applications, some of which are low latency applications. The Kikos, which was the system that ran in production, which was not built by our group, ran transaction clearance, banking transaction clearance applications. And it was chosen for reasons of reliability and security. And the original effort was developed by a company called Timeshare, which no longer exists. They created something called TimeNet, which also no longer exists by that name, which was the first large-scale commercial terminal network. Maybe it wasn't the first, but one of the biggest. Now, I could go on with a list of things that no longer exist that relied on time then. All these things get superseded over time. But the original impetus for timeshare, so timeshare was what it sounds like. They were in the timesharing business. This was when computers were expensive, which makes it before any of us were born. And they were in the business of leasing fractional machines. Right? And now that we have things like VMware or other variants of that story, we more or less take that for granted. At that time, the only machines that could do that were the IBM 360 and 370 class machines. And those were what were called big iron, big mostly referring to the size of the number of the check you wrote to buy one. It turns out that doing secure subdivision of those machines was an interesting problem, and accounting for it was an even more interesting problem. And that's what these guys were in the business of doing. And they concluded that the IBM software for doing that just wasn't going to get them to the place where they could bill reliably. Why? Because they actually observed users trying to cheat. Surprise. Ironically, it was not the case that they observed much spying between one company and another, but divisions operating within the same company were just ruthless to each other. I don't remember which of the automobile companies, but it was like one division in the automobile company was constantly trying to break into the computing resources of the other division of the same company. This is not a joke. On the other hand, I was not there, but I sort of believe the person who said this for a lot of reasons. Bug, and serious one that we now will have to go fix. Watch the commit messages. I do encourage you to get on Coyotes Dev, if only because it's an interesting mix of people who've built real systems, and those people are rare on the ground, and sometimes those discussions are going to be crazy and they're going to go over your head. And sometimes somebody's going to let with a, oh, no, you know, and other people are going to say, oh, yeah, we saw that on, you know, or we solved that in the following way. And you'll see back and forth that not only reflects the sort of the different generations of people, but also the different generations of systems that they worked on. And that's an interesting process to see, and it doesn't happen naked in public very often. And we've managed to convince some people to, maybe I don't want to go there. We've managed to convince some people to work with us in that way. Okay. All right, so we got a command line. We've said hello world. If you were to breakpoint the system at this point, what actually the first line comes up and says Coyotes rules. The BIOS people do not have exclusive rights in marketing. Hopefully that scrolls off the display before the customer notices. Okay, then we get to something called the transmap, and I don't remember if I've talked about the transmap. No. Okay. Good. So, what is the transmap? What's the problem that the transmap is trying to solve? We had a discussion about virtual memory. Now, the kernel doesn't get to take all of it. Most users, in my experience, would like at least some of that for themselves. If you want to use a machine with a large amount of physical memory, you're going to need some data structure that's going to at least keep track of that physical memory. At a minimum, I need to know whether a page is in use and who's got it. Probably need to put them on a free list or an aging list. That's a couple of pointers. There are several different purposes that I could use a page frame for, and I probably want to record, well, this page frame is being used as part of the kernel heap, and that page frame is being used for some user state, and this page frame went to market, and that page frame went wee-wee-wee all the way home. Okay, more references for small child jokes. Maybe it's that we have a new, almost three-year-old, so I'm getting exposed to these jokes again as an adult. My son is trying to figure out knock-knock jokes, but he hasn't got the part where, you know, he says knock-knock, and he waits for you to say who's there. He says knock-knock, and then he gives you what he thinks the punchline is, and he's still kind of sorting that out, which is really actually sort of fun to watch. I was kind of enjoying having forgotten knock-knock jokes, but I'm not going to tell him that. And hopefully he won't hear this until he has also forgotten knock-knock jokes. Okay, so this data structure, this is just a bookkeeping structure, right? It doesn't do anything useful. Let's do some arithmetic. So on a 64 gigabyte physical memory system, which is what a Pentium can address, we have 2 to the 36 bytes available memory. I got my arithmetic right. Page, 2 to the 12 bytes, and okay, how many of you can subtract 12 from 36 and are willing to tell me the answer? It's 2 to the 28, right? We tried this last week. It's 2 to the 24. Okay, so I got this bookkeeping structure, and you know, couple pointers and a tight field and, you know, something else. Is the page dirty, right? Do I need to think about writing it down before I let it go? Stuff like this. It's pretty easy to get to a bookkeeping structure that's 48 buttons. We've got two pointers, we're already at 8. We're going to find two other pointers somewhere. I mean, you can see the taxes rising, right? And in fact, the best we've done is about 48 bytes. I know how we could shrink that, but we'd lose some other things that we're using. So, but let's assume it was 32 bytes because that's a power of 2. But I can't add, even though you guys can. So 2 to the 24 and 2 to the 5 is 2 to the 29. That's good. That's good because if we're willing to devote a gigabyte of the virtual memory address space to the kernel, we've only used half of it for bookkeeping. Because a gigabyte would be to the 30. If, however, we wanted to restrict the kernel to half a gigabyte, we'd have a bit of a problem. Namely, we haven't got room for the kernel anymore. We also haven't got room for any of those other data structures we wanted. And it turns out there's a set of natural ratios that emerge in practice between the number of pages you have and the number of GPTs you have. And if you work the arithmetic, you will conclude that if you have 64 gigabytes worth of pages that are actively in use, which are occupying half a gigabyte of kernel virtual space, you will discover that you will want more than half a gigabyte worth of GPT structures. And bingo, you're out of memory. Thank you for playing. So there's a problem. And the transmap attempts to solve this problem, and it does not do so completely. Now, even before you get to the bookkeeping problem, notice that 64 gigabytes of pages fit into 1 gigabyte of kernel virtual space how many times? Good. Or 4 gigabytes of memory, which more systems actually have, or 2 gigabytes of memory, physical memory, fit into 1 gigabyte of virtual space how many times? I mean, you can't map all the physical memory into the kernel space on machines. Things were easier when we started. So the solution is to say, well, I won't. If I can't, obviously I won't, right? I mean, and now I got two solutions. I can go buy a Microsoft machine, or I can get stubborn. Being me, I'm sure you know which one I chose. What I have to do then is say, okay, I'm not going to map those pages except when I'm looking at them. When I look at them, I'm going to create what's called the transient map. I'm going to map them long enough to do what I got to do, and then I'm going to let them go. And it's going to turn out that a given operation in the kernel manipulates a relatively small number of pages. There are exceptions to that statement, but that's generally true. Ones that manipulate more than that are rarely actually used, and they only manipulate them one at a time. So in terms of the number of simultaneous pages I have to have, it's still a manageably small number. So the transient map is a mapping table reserved for this purpose. And catch is, we're going to get into this problem of physical memory pretty early. Because in theory, if we had 64 gigabytes of physical memory, Grub was entitled to put all of that temporary state just about as high up as it wanted to. If it put it above the 4 gigabyte limit, let me tell you, it doesn't. But if it did, right, that would still be within the specification. And there are other things that we might want to look at that are going to be above that limit later on. And in fact, we've only built a map in boot.s for the first 2 megabytes or the first 4 megabytes of memory, depending on which machine we're on. So even to zero the memory above 4 megabytes, we're going to have to do something. Like to zero them in order to put them in the kernel heap. You mentioned we have to build our own heap. So we're going to need some way to map them, and that's what the transmap does. So here's what's going to happen, and I'll do the legacy page table structure, is we're going to have a page directory, and we already have at this point one page table that maps either the low 2 meg or the low 4 meg, depending on which mapping system we're using. And we're going to have a second page table called a transmap, and transmap exists in two senses in the memory map, and this is where it gets a little tricky. It is a page table because that's the whole point. In order to build temporary mappings of pages, we need to have a page table into which we can write those mappings. Transmap is 4. Merely having it in the mapping tree as a page table is not enough to allow us to write to it. So if we were to look at the low area of the kernel map, we would discover that it looks like this, that there's a bunch of code, and there's a hole, and then there's data. And anybody who wants the details can go spend a bunch of time squinting at ldscript.s. That hole. I said we had to pre-allocate storage for the early mapping tables. This hole is 3 pages long plus, you know, whatever got left over at the end of the code. What's in it? Each directory, each table, and the transmap. A hole in 2 senses. It's a hole in the sense that there is nothing in the file at those locations. But it's also a hole in the sense that if we were to look at the kernel virtual map, there's low memory. There's one of many copies of the ROM because more is better, right? And then the code starts at 1 megabyte. Oh, there's actually another page down there, which is the user trampoline system call page, and we'll come back to that. I don't remember offhand how big the code is. I think it's running about 120 kilobytes right now, but we haven't turned on the optimizer. That would scare me if I didn't know a little bit about the optimizer. Or rather, it would scare me if I didn't know just how bad the code coming out of GCC when the optimizer is not turned on is. And then there's this hole, right? But this hole exists in the virtual map of the kernel as well. And it exists in the virtual map for this purpose that we're about to put it to. So when we initialize this page table that maps the low 4 megabytes, one of the things that we mapped as a consequence was the page that held the transmap. That lets us read and write it. That lets us build temporary mappings. That's what the transmap is for. So when we need to go allocate a page and do something with it, the protocol is going to be figure out which page we want, stick an entry for it in the transmap by constructing it by hand, do whatever we got to do, and drop it from the transmap. And after we drop it from the transmap, we're going to have to worry about invalidating the TLB, because the TLB likes to hold on to these answers long after we would like them to be gone. That's expensive, so we're going to be clever about it. Clever is a 4-letter word. It's one of those words your mother didn't want you to know when you were a child. Okay. We're not only going to do this for data pages, we're going to do it for page tables. So if we've got to manipulate a page table to build part of a user map, we're going to use the transmap to map the page that holds the page table. It's turtles all the way down. And ask Scott to explain that story to you, because I've done it too many times. It's already on tape, so why do it again? I said we were going to cheat about the TLB. So I said we don't have very many entries in the transmap. Well, in fact, we're going to typically have 0. And in cases where we have any at all, we're going to have like 2 or 3 or 4. And then once in a while, we're not going to get lucky. And it turns out that with high likelihood, when you enter the kernel, it's pretty bimodal, right? You're either going back to the same process that came in because it was doing something fast, or it was doing a message to somebody else, and you're going to go to somebody else. If you're going to go to somebody else, you're going to whack the TLB on the way out anyway. Why do it twice? I'm not going to go to somebody else. It turns out, with high likelihood, the path the user actually used was not a path that involved mapping any pages. The key words there were "with high likelihood." Here's the way this works. There is exactly one place in the kernel code where it whacks the TLB. When it does so, it reaches over to the transmap and says, "By the way, I whacked the TLB." So anything that you have deallocated but you have not gotten around removing from the TLB, it's removed. Now you know. So a slot in the transmap can be in one of 3 states. Currently in use, currently allocated, and therefore presumptively in the TLB, or at least the possibility exists and we have to be conservative. Or has been released but has not yet been known to be dropped from the TLB. It is known to be dropped from the TLB when one of 2 things happened. Either the TLB whacker tells us the TLB has been whacked, or you ask for one more page and we don't have any, and then we will go ahead and whack them. So it's a lazy scheme. I should explain maybe why whacking the TLB is important. We have these mapping tables, right? And your process is not my process, and we're kind of hoping that they don't share mappings by accident. Share mappings by construction and by intent, that's okay, but you should not be able to read my data merely because the kernel was too lazy to drop the mapping correctly. The way in which that happens is that the processor loads the mapping out of the mapping tables, and you go and change the mapping structure in some way, but the processor isn't watching. So when you change the mapping structure, generally, you actually have to explicitly make sure the entry gets taken out of the TLB, or it will linger there until it gets overwritten by the chance of caching. This is another one of those bugs that you will have a very hard time reproducing, because mostly it'll get whacked, just through reuse. Fortunately, sometimes it won't, so you don't get to rely on it. What we do is rely on, you know, sort of knowledge of the distribution of invocations so that we don't have to whack the TLB unnecessarily. And the reason for that is that whacking the TLB is very expensive. Because what happens when you whack the TLB goes like this. Up the processor, you say, everything you thought you knew about the memory map, forget it. Then you try to run an instruction. Sorry, everything doesn't mean drop the root pointer for the mapping table. It means drop everything in the cache. Then you're going to run the next instruction. But the kernel has forgotten the mapping. Excuse me, the hardware has forgotten it. So now the hardware goes, and it walks your memory map, trying to figure out how to reconstruct the mapping for this instruction. We're still in the kernel. We haven't actually done anything important yet. And 40 to 400 cycles later, it reconstructs the mapping, and it runs the next instruction. And one-third of the time, that instruction is a load or a store, at which point the kernel discovers that it's forgotten that mapping, too. You do the math. If you have a 32-entry TLB, it takes 400 cycles to reload each entry. What's the cost of dumping the TLB? It's not infinite, but it's large. It's enough that you don't want to do it redundantly. 12,000 cycles is significantly larger than some total kernel paths. There are some mechanisms that the processor provides to ameliorate this. One of them is something that's often known as the global bit. I mentioned we checked for that in boot.s. So the global bit says, when you're told to whack the TLB, don't whack this one. What it's used for is to say, by the way, this page, it's something that should be shared everywhere. For example, it's kernel code, and I'd really like not to lose that one. And it's okay for that one to be mapped everywhere. That's an optimization. Even if we just consider user mappings, we'd like not to throw them out unnecessarily. On the Pentium, we actually often have no choice. The problem on the Pentium is that the TLB does not remember which process the entry came from, and so we have to flush it when we switch processes. On more advanced processors, there is a memory of this. And in fact, on later AMD processors, you can tell it to flush the cache. It doesn't actually do it. Because it did tag the entries, and it does keep track of what changes you make to memory, and it flushes them later. But architecturally, you don't know that. I mean, you may know that because you know something about the chip, but you can't rely on it architecturally. All right. At this point, we are able to build the heap. No, we're not. Okay, now we got to go figure out physical memory. Figuring out physical memory is actually not a hard thing to do. There are two parts to it that are mildly tricky. First is that the table that Grub has left for us contains physical memory addresses. Of course, in order to read those addresses, we're going to have to map them. Isn't it convenient that we have the transmap to do that in? Once you get it mapped, it's mostly just a matter of reading a vector of data structures, except it's not a vector, it's a linked list. In fact, it's not really a linked list. It's actually... It's a linked list where the next pointer is encoded as an offset from the current entry. Unfortunately, they left the next pointer out in the original specification, where it actually was just a vector. And then when they went back and added it, they added it at offset -1 from the actual pointer. So you have to do some pointer arithmetic to get, this was kind of embarrassing when they noted that one. It was sort of an obvious thing missing. So there's just a little bit of pointer cruftiness to read this data structure. This is a minor nuisance. Basically, you're walking a linked list where the link pointer has been put in a really stupid place. And you do have to memory map it, and you want to be a little careful about that because you cannot assume... here's the catch. So I have some data structure, right? It's a small data structure. All I want to do is get the data out of it and move on. I know nothing about where this data structure is mapped. And in particular, it could appear in such a way that it crosses a physical page boundary. If we did the code right, you'll see it doesn't just chase the link pointer in the obvious way. It puts a data structure on the stack that's the same size as this data structure, and it calls memcopy p to v. Memcopy p to v is just memcopy. It's just copying bytes from one place to another. except that internally, when it's doing the from, the P part, it builds temporary mappings. So essentially, we copy the data structure into a place where we can deal with it, and then we look at the copy. This is a list of physical memory regions. Each one of them has a base, a bound, and a byte, which is called its type, which is not specified by grub, but happens to be the type code returned by the underlying BIOS. That type code is a useful thing to know because it tells us whether this is RAM or ROM. Storing useful data in ROM is not real helpful, so that's something you want to know. We're simply going to walk these structures, and for each one, we're going to call the physical memory allocator, and we're going to say, by the way, here is a region of physical memory that we get to use. Or, here is a physical region of memory that we need to know about. And we can do that, with apologies to Elliot. There's one thing we have to do first, which is we have to determine what is our physically addressable span. What do I mean by that? If we're using the legacy mapping mode, and you actually have that really hot graphics card and a lot of memory, and you're really lucky and you have the modern memory controller that will avoid them overlapping each other, you have memory we can't reach. Because the highest physical address the legacy mapping mode can express is 4 gigabytes. If you have more, cool. You have a wonderfully efficient heat source, but that's all you have. If we're using the new model, we can go up to 64 gig, but we're going to run into this virtual memory limitation, so we actually won't agree to go that high. In either case, the first thing we want to do is say, look, notwithstanding the memory you have, here's the memory region that I'm willing to deal with. It is possible that grub will tell us about a region that goes past that. Maybe I said I'm only willing to deal with 4 gig, and you put 8 gig on your machine. But I'm using the old mapping scheme for some reason. Grub didn't really tell us this. Grub is merely an agent. The BIOS told us this. Right? Grub asked the BIOS, handed this information to us, because by the time we get here, it's a real pain in the neck to ask the BIOS. So the very first call that's made to the PMEM subsystem is PMEM init, and what it passes in is the physically addressable range that we're willing to deal with given our mapping mode. Not hugely exciting. And then it proceeds through each of the regions reported by grub, and says, here's a new region that you need to know about. Now, you might think that the BIOS would have the grace to report regions that do not overlap. This would involve many assumptions about the quality of BIOS writers that do not appear to be validated in the wild. And in fact, they do. I have seen that error. There's a different error that's very similar in nature that's more common, which is that the BIOS will fail to report something, or it will report something that conflicts with another piece of information you already know. So the example we tripped over recently, there is something called the extended BIOS data area. The BIOS data area is basically the bottom page. Right. Sooner or later, they realized, you know, the BIOS might want more than a page of RAM, so they got another one. And there's a standard place where the extended BIOS data area actually lives on all machines. There's a place you go in the low page to find out where the high page went, but it always has the same answer. High page then has encoded in its first byte how big it is, so it could be more than a page. We recently saw a system that alleged to us that the range between 0 and, 640 less a little bit. So it was below A, so it was probably...
9F40.
Yeah, 9F. I take it you read the note. So, yeah. So it alleged that that region was good. Don't hold me to the number. It's not important, and it's on the Kyoto's dev list because I was ranting about this. And we happen to know that there's a ROM that starts, no, it was higher than this, because it was just below the ROM. That there's a ROM that starts above this, someplace like that. The extended BIOS data area can consist of a mix of RAM and ROM. Guess where it was? Fully straddling two of the regions that the BIOS had reported previously. This mostly proves is that the left-handed BIOS author doesn't know what the right-handed BIOS author is doing. And you're actually forced to check, you can't assume. The PMAP code also adds by hand some well-known regions that we would like not to overwrite. For example, we'd like not to lose the BIOS data areas. We are not going to use them. There may be application level code that wishes to, and we don't want to throw them away. We want to mark those regions as, you know, known to be things we'd like to reserve for future use, and therefore we would not like to allocate them to be part of the heap, for example. That would be rude. So there's a few checks. There's also legacy issues because of the users who have older machines. Some of them don't even have this fancy stuff that the BIOS will report. And that's all that the PMEM initialization stuff does. Now, if you go down into the physical memory allocator, you'll see that it's a very, very simple allocator. There's a bunch of things going for it. One, all records are the same size. This is, if you're writing a memory allocator, this is like a gift from God, because you don't have to do any worry about any kind of fragmentation issues. It operates out of statically allocated resource. One thing that would be bad to do would be to be required to allocate a page in order to store the information about which pages are available to be allocated, which is precisely the situation that Grubb bequeathed to us. Another possible design, feasible, we chose not to do it, would be just like we pre-allocated space here, we could pre-allocate a page for the heap and rely on the fact that this is the very first allocation that we do and that the rest of it would bootstrap. Chose not to do that because there was another advantage to pre-allocating this vector, which is that it's easier to sort if it's a vector. And we want to keep it in sorted order. Why? Because that's the easiest way to find things in it and discover if the BIOS people have helped us. Also, it's going to be the easiest way later to keep track of if you come along and say, I need a capability to this particular physical page, we're going to want to check whether that's known to be a device page or something else. To do that, we're going to have to do a lookup. So what you'll find if you dig into the FISMEM code is it's just a fixed length vector, right? It's got a base and a bound and a type and a current use, and I think that's about it. And a string saying what was our excuse for allocating it, which is purely a debugging matter. And may go away. There is a risk that we will run out. I mean, it's hypothetically conceivable that you could have a very large system with a very rich PCI tree, all of which devices actually present memory on the system bus that we need to know about. So USB is not an issue here. Certainly on 64-bit machines, that's more plausible than on 32-bit machines, because on 32-bit machines, there's just only so much memory to go around. I know of one physical machine that this implementation probably would not resolve. But what we're observing at the moment is, in practice on real machines, I think we're allocating about 24 entries, and I think the number available is 128, so I don't really feel real pressure. The only really tricky bit in there is, because we want to keep them sorted, there's a problem with how do we make sure that the free entries bubble to the top, and there's a trick in the comparison routine to make sure, A, that they bubble to the top, and B, that they are, that you get a stable sort out of the result. So one of the problems with using something like QSort or HeapSort is if you compare two elements and one time their A is less than B, and if you later compare the same two elements and the thing comes back and says B is less than A, the sort may not terminate. In this case, they're all co-equal, and so we applied a tiebreaker by choosing the higher address, which violates my earlier statement that we were trying to avoid such tricks. That's it. Real complicated for physical memory. Oh, but now we know where it is. This is a good thing. Because now we're allowed to have heap. Sorry. Almost. Heap keeps getting later and later and later now that I'm looking at this. Okay. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to protect the multi-boot regions. We're going to artificially take the regions that multi-boot handed us that holds this information that we're about to save. And we're going to mark those regions as taken. We will undo this later. Until we get them, we don't want to lose them. So we want to mark them as in use. Now, at this point, in principle, we can start the heap, because now that we've marked those regions as not to be disturbed, we can allow the heap system to allocate pages, because we know we won't allocate one of those pages that's in use. And that's been the whole purpose of this dance to this point. It's convenient to do a few other things first that are early things that we probably don't even really need to do yet. We could do heap at this point. There's no reason not to. But it turns out that, you know, you start doing the heap, you're going to start manipulating the memory map. And you're going to start manipulating the memory map in non-trivial ways. So far, everything that we have touched, we've touched through the transmap, which was statically pre-allocated. There are ways to go wrong doing that, and the symptom if we go wrong doing that will be the advertising. As we started to growing the heap, we're going to do more complicated manipulations of the memory map. And we'd like to get something better than a reboot if we mess them up. In order to get something better than a reboot if we mess them up, We need to be able to take a page fault and survive the experience. In order to take a page fault and survive the experience, we need to initialize what's called the exception vector table. Actually, two. There's one that the hardware knows about, which is called the interrupt descriptor table. In the Pentium family, interrupts and exceptions come through the same vector of entries. In our case, we have a parallel table in software, which is where we put all the information we care about. And so we want to initialize it here, because if we take a page fault, if we take a general protection fault, if we do a bad access, we'd like to know about it. So you want to get that done before you start doing anything too excessively clever with the state of the machine. All that does is assemble values into statically allocated vectors. So for example, if you were to look at a file called interrupts.s, which was not on the list for today, you would discover that it has the world's ugliest macro assembler for generating 256 vector entries, each of which consists of three instructions, the last of which branches to a common thing. Why do this? Because of those 256 entries, there are only a small list of exceptional cases. All of the others are of the form push I, where I is something between 0 and 256, push 0, branch to the common path. Because the helpful designers at Intel neglected to provide a mechanism in the hardware that would tell us which entry we took. Each entry will go to a different address if you program it that way, but that's it. Once you've got the address, you're on your own. And there are probably other tricks we could have used to do this without pushing the number of the entry. This is simpler. And then there are those five exceptional cases. So what about that 0 that we pushed? That 0 that we pushed occupies a hole in the stack, which in five cases gets an error code that's pushed by the hardware. And the delightful decision by the hardware designers was to create an irregular trap frame. So if you get one of the cases that pushes an error code, the trap frame looks like one thing. And if you get one of the cases that does not push an error code, the word is simply missing. They didn't push a 0. And in order to regularize the trap frame, you want to push the 0 so everything looks alike. And so you end up writing this 100-some-odd instruction sequence for the purpose of recovering from the hardware design. Having written this long sequence, the problem is to know you need the address of the first instruction in each of these small sequences. Why? Because you need to put that address into the hardware vector table. Why? So the hardware vector knows to go there so that you can push the number that you really wish the hardware had given you in the first place. Oh, but these were generated by macroassembler, and I didn't want to type 256 of these things because I'm not that good on the keyboard. So there's a second trick that captures the addresses of each of these as we go, and that ends up in a 256 entry table. Unfortunately, for reasons of legacy compatibility, the table is not something we can use as the hardware vector table. Yes, we need to put those pointers into the hardware vector table, but because of the accident of history of how the 3D6 emerged, we can't actually just build the table in place because the field that holds the pointer is broken into like three subfields. And that pointer has to be divided up and put in the right places in the field. And that's something the linker isn't smart enough to know how to do. So I have to look because very recent linkers have added some support that might be just barely good enough. So having created three tables for the benefit of one, what this vector init pass does is that mainly it just goes and copies the one pointer table into the hardware table. Along the way, it makes note that some of these vectors are actually exceptions triggered by user instructions and that it's okay for users to do that. So in particular, there's an instruction that says, trap if the overflow bit is set. And if you don't tell the hardware, it's okay for the user to run this instruction, and they do it, what you get is a general protection fault, which is not the overflow trap you had in mind. Other little initialization things like this. Right? All of this is undoing the wisdom of the Intel designers. If you're the person writing this code, boy, are you really inclined to complain about it, as I just did. It is hard to argue with the financial success of their decision, so let's give them credit where it's due, because I mostly won't. Question there? Okay. At this point, we can take page faults and say, oops. Because we now have told the hardware how to get to the code that says, oops. And then the last thing we're going to do here, and honestly, I don't think it belongs here, is we're going to call CPU probe CPUs. Why did I do this here? OK, yes, right. In an SMP machine, I want to know early how many CPUs there are. And I want to know certain things about their hardware data structures. So, and let me be clear that this code now, the probe CPU code is working, but it's not actually building the CPU tables correctly. So if you have more than one processor, we stop. On newer systems, newer Pentium systems, every processor has something called a local APIC. Local APIC stands for Advanced Peripheral Interrupt Controller. Advanced is a value judgment. I invite you to draw your own conclusions. In contrast to the older devices that tended to show up on things called I/O ports, when Intel introduced the local APIC, they adopted the same style of design that was done by many other processors, where the way you talk to a device is you memory map it. And so if the device has registers that you need to talk to, they show up somewhere in the physical memory address space. And you write to them by writing to those physical locations as opposed to I/O ports, which are a separate hardware feature. And when Intel introduced the local APIC, which was somewhere in the middle of my PhD, they decided to adopt that design. So the deal is that unless you arrange otherwise, my processor's local APIC appears at a well-known physical address. Your processor's local APIC appears at the same well-known physical address. If I make a reference to that part of my physical address space, your processor will not see it. Unfortunately, there are a few earlier processors for which that last part isn't true, which is why you might want to rearrange the local APICs, but we're not bothering. Also something called an I/O APIC. So here's the division of labor. On the old system, pre-APIC, an interrupt would come in, it would go to the peripheral interrupt controller. This was the pre-advanced version. I can assure you that version was not advanced. That chip would figure out which interrupt should win, and it would yank on a pin of your processor and say, I need attention, and you'd go talk to it. And there was no cause for confusion because there was only one processor in the system. In modern systems, what happens, modern is a funny word, what happens is there's another chip that replaced the PIC, called the I/O APIC. I/O because it deals with input and output. And this chip's job is to take all of those I want attention requests. And when it gets such a request, it chooses a processor that will be told about. Okay. So the picture that I'm drawing is not true to the hardware, but it's logically accurate. That on most systems, you have an I/O APIC, and conceptually, you have a bunch of lines hanging off the I/O APIC that hardware uses to yank for attention. And then you have a sequence of CPUs, each of which has a local APIC, and there's a shared bus that's used only to deal with interrupt information. The I/O APIC gets programmed early on to say where certain interrupts should be delivered. And you can say this interrupt goes there, this interrupt goes here, this interrupt goes to any of the following three, this interrupt goes to market. You want to do that early on. We haven't done that yet. What's going to happen is the I/O APIC says, I have an interrupt that should go to processors in group 3. And separately, you've told the processors, you're in group 3, you're not. You're in group 3, you're not. And one of them will pick it and win. I don't know which one. Why? You actually want to distribute the workload of interrupts across the processors, at least in some system designs. Now, about those I/O APICs. I would predict that all of the systems that you guys own, unless you're in the business of running a big server, have one I/O APIC on the system. And the reason is that 24 interrupt pins is enough for most machines. However, if you have a fancy high-end machine, which has multiple primary PCI buses, it is possible to need more. And you could end up with multiple I/O APICs, and the BIOS will tell you the physical address of each of these I/O APICs. Generally speaking, it would be really bad to allocate part of your heap out of an I/O APIC. So, the reason that we call CPU probe CPUs here is that down inside that routine, it calls ACPI probe CPUs. ACPI is the advanced something power interface. Advanced configuration of power interface, something like this. And among the things that's in those tables is information like how many CPUs do you have, what flavor of the month were they, and where did the I/O APICs go? And also where did the local APICs go? And here again, we want to take judicial notice of those physical memory locations. I'd like to believe that the BIOS did not tell us they were RAM. Experience suggests that we would be ill-advised to believe that. Again, the left-handed designer does not know what the right-handed designer did. So we do that probe, and now we know how many CPUs there are, and more important, we're now done looking at all the pieces of memory that the kernel is going to know about for quite a long time. Let me say, at this point, we're trying to identify those CPUs. We are not trying to start them. Yeah.
So all of this is API AML?
Yes. The IOA pick information is in the primary tables. With AML gives you information about drivers, shutdown, power up. There's information we're not getting. So we don't know things like if you have the fancy graphics card on the PCI bus, we don't know what window of memory that's going to get. But whatever window the BIOS assigned it to, we're probably going to change it anyway, so there's really no point finding out. We do have reason to know that it does not fall within the RAM region that the BIOS has reported to us, I think. This is a hypothesis that I need to go buy some fancy graphics cards and check.
That's your story and you're sticking to it.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it. That's right. Okay. So at this point, we got everything we hopefully need to know about the physical memory, and we can go ahead and find out what's left. That's what this call to PMEM total available, PMEM available does. Oh, let me explain the arguments to that. The question that we're asking, we're saying how much memory is available of a certain type. Type means between the following base and the following bound. Am I interested only in the largest available contiguous region, or as many as I could possibly get if I kept asking? And then what's the unit about which I'm asking? So if I've got 4 bytes of memory left, the answer to how many pages are left is 0. If I have 4 kilobytes of memory left, but they're not aligned in such a way that I could build a full page out of them, the answer to how many pages are left is 0. So that's, and the reason is, I'm going to come back and call this routine a couple of times, and sometimes I'm going to need pages, and I have alignment constraints for that. And sometimes I'm going to be happy with bytes, and I won't care. We're just about out of the woods. Okay, at this point, we're going to process the command line, which amounts to turning on a few flags and saving the rest, now that we can. Let's see, somewhere in here, yes, buried about line 713, there's a call to heap init. Because we now know enough to allocate pages, and that means we can put things into the heap, because we can build a heap. And I'll come back to heap init next time. Okay, then we're gonna process the command line, then we're gonna reserve space for page tables, which is all that page table init does. CPU vector init is somehow doing, I don't remember, oh yeah, that one's something we're not actually doing yet. CPU scan features is purely to prove that we can. It was a nice early test. It should go away. GDT, LDT init, TSS init, these are simply initializing some tables whose format the hardware dictates to us that we're more or less stuck with. IRQ init I'm going to go through next time because we're actually doing some interesting things there. That's where we're going to talk to these IOA picks and LA picks and figure out where they went. And the last thing we're going to do here is initialize the hard clock, which is misnamed. The hard clock is actually the interval timer. So this is essentially where the PC comes with several clocks, right? More is better. Each generation has added a newer, faster, better clock. Why do I care? Because when I set your process running, I want to be able to tell it to stop, and if it doesn't stop of its own accord, I'm going to use the clock to interrupt it to get into the kernel so that I can tell it to stop. I have to tell the timer how fast I want it to go. And that's most of what hard clocking it does. I also need to wire up its interrupt, because it's got at least logically a pin that it's going to tug, and I need to tell it which pin that should be. I need to tell it how fast the base timer should run, a few little initialization things like that. Nothing hugely exciting, just enough to force me to have really detailed understanding of how the interrupt subsystem works, which is the piece I said I would come back to next time. At this point, I get past hard clock init, I am done with architecture-specific initialization. I will not try to do them all today, but let me just tell you what's going to come. So at this point, architecture-dependent portion of the code has directly or indirectly caused a bunch of memory to be allocated. Most of that memory is in the heap. Now got all it's ever going to be entitled to. One of the properties of this system is it does a semi-static allocation of memory. It does all its decisions early, and having done them, it never lets go. The difference between a Rottweiler and a Jewish mother. I have a Jewish mother and I told her this joke, right? The Rottweiler eventually lets go. My mother did not think this was so funny. I don't know why. Okay. I did Roddy Rescue for many years, so I have a long list of bad Rottweiler jokes, if anybody is interested. Whatever memory is left is there for the taking, and oh boy, are we going to take it. So what is going to happen now is we're going to go back to Kern main. Remember I said main memory is used as a cache? Now that's going to come true. We're actually going to go and allocate the vectors that are going to hold those objects in main memory. And we're going to allocate them, for the most part, out of the heap. The only part we're not going to allocate out of the heap is the region that holds page space. The reason we're not going to do that is that page space has alignment requirements, and we don't have enough virtual memory to hold it anyway. So we're going to allocate that separately. But the bookkeeping structures are going to come out of the heap. And then after we're done with that, we're going to make one last callback into the architecture-specific code saying, we're done and we're ready to run user code. At that point, there's an opportunity for the architecture-dependent code to say, I held back some memory that I didn't tell you about. And I'll tell you what that memory is. Remember I said there were two things we loaded at the beginning, a kernel and an image? Well, immediately after we allocate the vectors to hold the objects, we're going to take the contents of the image and we're going to copy them into the vectors where they belong. That image might be pretty big. So after we've copied it out of the way, we're going to release the memory that the image occupied, and we're going to go back to the object vector allocator, and we're going to say there's some more. What's happened prior to this is the object vector allocator has done two computations. One says, how much memory would I have if the image were already free? And it's going to do its partitioning based on that number. And it's going to grab only as much as it can get, which is not going to include the pieces of the image because they're still reserved. It's going to do a callback that says, I have copied the image. The architecture-dependent code is now going to let go of the image by removing it from the reserved list, and it's going to say, good, you can now have that piece of memory. This is all about not stepping on our own toes as we go through the dance. The architecture-dependent code is now going to claim the memory that was used by the image, and it's going to start the first application, we hope. At that point, it's going to dispatch the scheduler for the first time. The scheduler is going to pick a victim, and that victim will page fault, and we will come screaming back into the kernel. But we're done with the initialization. I'll go through those pieces in a little more detail, but not hugely more detail. There isn't a whole lot to it. There's the devil's in the details, and one of the beautiful things about this kind of code is reversing two lines can transition you from a machine that works fine to a machine that shows you advertising. I'm really down on that silly BIOS. I guess I've seen it too many times. But mostly the kernel's just going to get out of its own way, and that's what we're trying to accomplish. Okay, I've realized just now as we're finishing up that I owe you an apology. I am not leaving enough time for questions at the end. I will start doing that, and I apologize. I mean, you guys have been pretty good about interrupting as we go, and I've encouraged you to do that, and I want you to keep doing that. I will try to make sure I reserve time. If you have not gotten a note that you were on the class mailing list, you need to join it, see Scott, because I will be sending out first project details late this week. You want to get them. Or perhaps you don't. Good. Thank you. I will get these up before I scram out of town, but I unfortunately need to get up to a client in New York tonight. Any questions before we go? Unfortunately, I don't think we have a class coming in, so any questions before we go? Is this just totally confusing, or was it sort of interesting to see how this comes up? I'd like some feedback. This depends on what operating system you're looking at. Proportionally, in a microkernel, it will be larger because there's less of the rest. In this particular kernel, at the moment, we're sitting at 12,000 lines of code, and from memory, about 4,000 of it is architecture dependent. And these are funny metrics because it depends on the tool. And there's about 600 lines of assembler, much of which is comment.
How much of that will change to another architecture?
Okay, there's two questions there. One is how much would change, and the second is how much would go away. The Intel architecture requires an amazing amount of software workaround for legacy. So of that 4,000 lines of code, and I am making up a number here, I haven't looked at it carefully, best guess, almost 1,800 of it would go away simply by switching chips, because it serves no functional purpose. As to the rest, it depends on the architecture. We are going to be doing an implementation for the ColdFire next month, and we will find out the answer to your question the hard way. But my guess is all of the architecture-dependent code will change. In abstract, there's one place that might stay approximately the same, which is that if you have two processors that both use hierarchical mapping structures, the portion of the system that knows how to walk them and build the entries for them might be partly shareable. And we anticipate that that will be the case, but we haven't tried to break that out because we don't have a second practical example yet. We're talking about doing an architecture that actually would test that. The truth is, we're not, even if it were savable, it's not clear that it's worth it. It's not that much code. But interrupt handling is very CPU dependent, and that's most of what the architecture dependent code is doing. That process dispatch, right, getting a process running, and building page table entries, and that describes almost the entire function of the architecture dependent code. And of course, if your chip were the same as my chip, we'd be in court doing patent battles, so it follows that the software won't be the same. Other questions? Okay. If you have not already, I know you haven't already done so, Scott is going to be creating accounts on a machine for the project, and I will email out details, so please get on. Oh, let me give you the location. www.coyotos.org, mailman, listinfo, all one word, and you will see CS439 as a possible list to join. In case you don't know, this is CS439. Please get on the list. Let me put it more strongly. If you're taking the course for credit, things that are sent on the list are material that you are responsible for. Well, and the only reason I'm being a hard case about it is if I don't have a way to communicate with you, we're sunk. Also, please take note, the list is not moderated. Those of you who got the early notes already know this. But so when you can send mail to the list, and that's partly because I really want to encourage discussion. But when you do, keep in mind that if you put a question on the list about the project or about an assignment, everybody in the room is going to see it. And that may be okay, and it may not. I'm inclined to run this pretty open. In fact, I want to encourage that to be okay, and I'm going to try to set up projects and assignments so that it is okay. But you should be aware of the issue. You're not just sending it to me. In past classes, I have tended to moderate that list simply so I got a chance to say no before the oops got out. I'm not doing that this year, so be aware that if you send it, it goes. Scott's going to create accounts. He will be sending you passwords. Did you ask for public keys?
I asked for public keys. I'll be sending it to people, not sending keys. Okay. But I'm trying
if you're not real familiar with SSH keys, the one you want to send is the one with the .pub on it. If you send him the one without the .pub, he is you. And frankly, that's likely to be disturbing to both of you, so don't do it. Okay, let's get out of here. I see somebody.